I'm Pam Puso, Fox News. The number of dead worldwide from the coronavirus has topped 3 million, according to Johns Hopkins University. In the U.S., more than 566,000 people have died as new infections continue to mount.
Our seven-day average is up to 69,500, nearly 70,000 new cases per day.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. An emergency curfew was put in place last night in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, after angry demonstrators breached a fence outside the police department. About 100 people arrested.
Tearing down a fence, coming armed to a protest is not, in my mind, befitting a peaceful protest.
John Harrington is the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. For a sixth night, people gathered to protest the police shooting death of Dante Wright. In North Carolina, windows were reportedly smashed as protesters in Durham reacted to recent police shootings. Local media also says an American flag was burned. The eight victims of Thursday's shooting at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis have been identified, along with the suspect who police say turned the weapon on himself.
19-year-old Brandon Hull. FedEx officials have confirmed that Mr. Hull was a former employee at the facility, and he was last employed in 2020.
Deputy Police Chief Craig McCart. Last year, Hull's mother called police to say that her son might commit suicide by cop. The teenager was questioned, and authorities removed a gun from his home. Britain's royal family is preparing for the funeral of Prince Philip. He'll be laid to rest later today at Windsor Castle. He was 99. America's listening to Fox News. Out of the hundreds of people charged in the January riot on Capitol Hill, one of them has pleaded guilty.
Oath Keeper member John Schaefer was looking at six charges, but has agreed to plead guilty to two counts, obstructing the certification of the 2020 election and breaching a restricted building. He was initially accused of using pepper spray against police officers. Court records say the FBI caught Schaefer inside the building wearing a sweatshirt and baseball cap that said Oath Keeper's lifetime member.
Fox's Jessica Rosenthal. A source tells Fox News Schaefer has agreed to cooperate with authorities against others who face charges. The mask mandate in Michigan has been extended by 5 weeks, and later this month it will apply to toddlers who attend daycare or camp. For weeks, Michigan has had the country's highest daily COVID-19 infection rate, and this week, hospitalizations hit a record. Johnson & Johnson is defending its coronavirus vaccine after its distribution was paused in the U.S.
Scientists at Johnson & Johnson are refuting claims by researchers at the University of Nebraska, whose work appears in the New England Journal of Medicine, that viral vector vaccines made with adenoviruses are the cause of blood clots in people like those who receive Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccines in the U.S. and in European cases where AstraZeneca's vaccine was given. The J&J team says the two vaccines are different in that theirs uses a human adenovirus, where AstraZeneca's used one from chimps, and that theirs alters the virus, whereas AstraZeneca does not.
Fox's Eben Brown. A CDC panel will review the data next week. A high-stakes contest between two of the world's richest men is over. NASA has awarded Elon Musk's SpaceX a nearly $3 billion contract to build a spacecraft to bring astronauts to the moon. Musk beat out Amazon Jeff Bezos. Pam Puso, Fox News.
Heads up in D.C. on 695. Westbound, construction, only one lane's getting past the work zone. This is between 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. In College Park on Cherry Hill Road, southbound, there's construction. Both right turn lanes are closed at Route 1. In Centerville on 66 westbound, exit 53, off-ramp is closed. And on the westbound side of 66, exit 57, the off-ramp is closed. Finally, on 95 northbound in Dumfries, there is construction. Only the left lane is getting past the work zone between Dumfries Road and Dale Boulevard. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV, with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update. 105.9 FM. Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And a lot to cover, obviously, with the events in Washington this week, the latest on the efforts to increase the size of the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about that at length this morning because it is a hot topic and we'll get it from a number of different perspectives. Also, the question about pulling troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th, that one is also a hot topic in Washington. But we're going to lead this morning with the topic that is sweeping the country these days, and that is the unrest and the outrage being expressed over incidents in which police are shooting and killing suspects. And there are two sides to the coin. You get one side in many areas of the media, and then sometimes you have to dig a little bit deeper to get the full story. And we're going to look at a couple of incidents this morning and go a little deeper into it. The one that has really been dominating the news in the past 24 hours is in Chicago. Now, the incident happened back in March, but the Chicago police released the video of the incident, and this was a shooting in Chicago, a 13-year-old killed in a split-second decision by a police officer. And what is not being talked about very much, and you just have to put it into the context to understand the full story, and that is police were responding to shots that had been fired at a vehicle. It's approximately 2:30 in the morning. The police responding to shots fired at a vehicle, and they find two suspects who are fleeing. The 13-year-old has a gun in his hand as he is running away from the police. And then in a split second, the 13-year-old throws down his gun and turns around and is shot by a police officer. Now, much is being made about the fact that this is a 13-year-old, but one should consider that it's 2:30 in the morning. It is a quote-unquote school night when this happens. I don't know that the officer would have realized that this was a 13-year-old that he was chasing, because all they were doing was responding to shots fired and chasing two suspects who were running away from them, and the 13-year-old had a weapon in his hand. It is a very troubling incident. If you've seen the video, it is obviously troubling. This is the attorney for Adam Toledo's family, Adina Weiss Ortiz, and here's the family's perspective.
You saw that video. Do you see a gun in his hands? I don't see a gun in his hands. But let's assume, for the moment, the worst, that he had a gun in his hands. The officer gave him a directive. The officer told him, show me your hands. The child complied. He surrendered. He lifted his hands. They were empty, and the child was shot.
That sounds like a very convincing argument, but the time that it took for that all to happen is explained by the head of the Chicago Police Union. This is John Catanzara.
That officer had 0.8 of a second to determine if that weapon was still in his hand or not, period. The officer does not have to wait to be shot at or shot in order to respond and defend himself. There's no obligation whatsoever.
John Catanzara of the Chicago Police Union continued in discussing the incident from their perspective.
The officer had every reason to believe that that offender was turning and pointing the gun at him. Whatever it had, you can Monday morning quarterback it all you want, but according to Illinois statute, you only need to have a reasonable belief in order to take deadly action.
So those are both sides of the story. Again, a very troubling video. What seems to be missing from so many of the discussions is the fact that often in these cases, a suspect is running from the police or is resisting arrest, and when you put yourself into that situation, you cannot guarantee that a police officer is going to be able to follow every ounce of training that that police officer has received in their entire career. It is split-second timing. You don't know if the officer perceives that you may be grabbing a weapon or going for a weapon or have a weapon. In the case in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, the suspect there had been out on a pending armed robbery charge, is the report. So you have a number of different circumstances all going on in split-second timing. And nobody is messaging to young people that I'm hearing in the media that if you put yourself in that position, you cannot guarantee the outcome is going to be positive and the outcome could be fatal. That's the message that should be out there to young people or whatever the age of a perpetrator or somebody that is having an interaction with the police that has a weapon or is resisting arrest or is running from the police. If you put yourself in that position, you are putting yourself at risk of death. You cannot guarantee the outcome. And I just think that's missing from the equation when it's the pile on the police who are in very difficult situations. I'm sure you saw the video of the police officer being gunned down, shot and killed in New Mexico in a routine traffic stop. These things happen. It's terrible when somebody like Adam Toledo is shot, but Adam Toledo should not have been in that position. The person that put him in that position was a 21-year-old. The 21-year-old is the one who actually fired the shots. He's been arrested on several felony counts, including child endangerment. Nobody's talking about him. All they want to do is blame the police. So, again, very troubling situation. There's both sides of the equation, but some points are missing from this debate. It is 6:16. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On 66 westbound in Centerville, at 28, the Centerville exit, exit 53, that off-ramp is closed. In Fairfax, on 66 westbound, at the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57, that ramp is also closed. Heads up in Fairfax on the eastbound side of 66, disabled vehicle right lane is blocked right near exit 60. And there's construction going on D.C. on 695 westbound. Only one lane is getting past the work zone between 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down, a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
39 degrees in the nation's capital, 617 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Well, you have heard the debate this week about court packing. You may recall that President Biden was opposed to court packing back during the campaign, but as many things that he said during the campaign, either they weren't true then or they're not true now, because he's changing his mind on that one. And, you know, he said, well, we're going to wait for the outcome of the commission. Well, why did you appoint the commission? Ed Markey and a group of progressives held a press conference out in front of the Supreme Court. That's a real nice thing to do. I thought we were supposed to have, like, separation of powers and checks and balances. And, you know, you have the judiciary, you have the legislative, and you have the executive branch. So much for that idea. Here's Ed Markey, one of our favorite senators from Massachusetts, explaining why they are there and why they're in favor of court packing.
We are here today because the United States Supreme Court is broken. It is out of balance. And it needs to be fixed. Too many Americans view our highest court in the land as a partisan political institution, not our impartial judicial branch of government.
I'm not sure that he actually advanced any evidence of all of this partisanship on the Supreme Court. That's Ed Markey, and they, of course, are in favor of packing the court. Now, here's Ed Markey continuing, and where else do you put the blame?
The court is broken. And make no mistake about it, the court is broken because leader Mitch McConnell, his Senate Republican colleagues, and Donald Trump broke it.
That's all Trump's fault. Everything's Trump's fault, right? We were in pretty good shape until Biden came in and screwed everything up, but it's all Trump's fault, right? One more from Ed Markey, because this kind of explains it.
And the way we repair it is straightforward. We undo the damage that the Republicans have done by restoring balance. And we do it by adding four seats to the court to create a 13-member Supreme Court. These four new seats, to be filled by President Biden, will reconstitute the United States Supreme Court.
Reconstitute? How about realign it to a 180, if that, or more? Reconstitute. Give me a break, Ed. You're not going to put that one past us. Even on a Saturday morning when it's early, you're not putting that one past us. Now, not only do they want to pack the Supreme Court, but they want to force Justice Stephen Breyer to resign. Okay? Now, Breyer has been on the court for 27 years. Okay? He's 82 years old. President Clinton appointed him in 1994. I think he's typically known as a more liberal justice versus a conservative justice. Now, Mondaire Jones is a freshman representative from the state of New York in the Congress. Breyer's been on the court 27 years. Mondaire has been on the planet 33 years because Mondaire Jones is 33 years old. So here's what Mondaire Jones's idea is about Justice Breyer.
There is no question that Justice Breyer, for whom I have great respect, should retire at the end of this term. I mean, my goodness, have we not learned our lesson?
My goodness, have you been around long enough to learn a lesson? Anyway, Politico sums it up. Democrats wrestle with whether to nudge a justice off the Supreme Court. Neither Democratic lawmakers nor President Joe Biden putting overt retirement pressure on the Supreme Court justice yet. Anyway, that was written, I guess, the hours before Mondaire said, I think he should retire. Democrats grappling with judicial deja vu. An aging liberal Supreme Court justice, a paper-thin Senate majority, and activist pressure to swing the bench leftward. Well, that's a sense. And, I mean, you've heard Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg thought it was a bad idea. Breyer thought it was a bad idea to pack the court, but they want to go for it. Lindsey Graham is going to put up the defense, and here's what he had to say. He spoke on Fox.
It's a slam on the court. We live in dangerous times at home and abroad, and our friends on the left are really drunk with power right now. The only reason Nancy Pelosi's not bringing up the court packing bill is that she knows she can't get it through the Senate because the filibuster still exists. Yeah. But if you want to destroy confidence in the rule of law, do what they're proposing. Every time there's a power shift in Washington when one party takes over from the other, the number of justices change, the makeup of the court changes. It becomes a political institution that will lose respect with the American people. So Justice Ginsburg got this right, and it's not going to go anywhere for the moment. But I'll be in front of the court next week with Senator Cruz giving our view of what we should be doing.
We're going to talk with Jim Trusty a little bit later on in the program, of course, our legal expert. We'll get his read on the court packing from the legal standpoint, and we'll talk with John Gizzi about court packing from the political standpoint this morning. You noticed how many stories about Donald Trump have now been debunked, things that were made up about Donald Trump during the campaign? How about this one? Remember the big deal about the Russian troop bounties, all of the criticism of President Trump because he wouldn't confront Vladimir Putin about the reports that the Russians had put out bounties in Afghanistan for American troops? Well, Joe Biden treated it as fact that U.S. intel agencies had determined Russia had paid the Taliban to kill Americans in Afghanistan. Well, that's been debunked now. A senior defense official said on Thursday they have still not found any evidence. The Biden administration also made it clear on a fact sheet released Thursday that the CIA intelligence on the matter is far from conclusive, acknowledging that analysts labeled it low to moderate confidence. Remember last year how rough they were? Well, Jonathan Swan is at Axios. He puts it in perspective.
It's been widely reported that the U.S. has intelligence indicating that Russia paid bounties or offered to pay bounties to Taliban fighters to kill American soldiers. Right. You had a phone call with Vladimir Putin on July 23rd. Did you bring up this issue?
No, that was a phone call to discuss other things. And frankly, that's an issue that many people said was fake news.
Who said it was fake news?
I think a lot of people.
Well, how about Joe Biden? Let's take you back. Back last year, this is the current president attacking the former president over the what is now basically a debunked story.
If the Times report is true, I emphasize again, is that President Trump, the commander in chief of American troops serving in a dangerous theater of war, has known about this for months, according to the Times, and done worse than nothing. Not only has he failed to sanction or impose any kind of consequences on Russia for this egregious violation of international law, Donald Trump has continued his embarrassing campaign of deference and debasing himself before Vladimir Putin.
Uh-huh. If the story is true, that's a real nice way to attack a president. If the story is true. Biden, he laid into it. That was not the only time he brought that one up.
His entire presidency has been a gift to Putin, but this is beyond the pale. It's a betrayal of the most sacred duty we bear as a nation, to protect and equip our troops when we send them into harm's way. And it's betrayed. It's a betrayal of every single American family with a loved one serving in Afghanistan or anywhere overseas. And I'm quite frankly outraged by the report.
Outraged by the report that was wrong, was false, never verified by the intelligence community. Okay, it's 6:27. It's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. It's the Saturday Morning Update. One of the things I think it's important for us to do here is if you're busy during the week and you don't have time to spend 8 hours a day listening to WMAL or, you know, watching some of the news channels, especially the news channels that were more conservative in nature, we like to bring out some of the stories that you won't see if you don't pay attention to WMAL or maybe Fox or Newsmax or OAN. And one of them is now, I think they've killed this story on Facebook. I think they've banned Project Veritas from Facebook now. I believe I heard that yesterday. And this is, I'll try and be brief, but Project Veritas, you know, they go out and they'll do some hidden camera videos. Well, they sat down with CNN technical director Charlie Chester. And Charlie was really chatty. Charlie really went into it and explained how they do things at CNN. And if you go to Project Veritas website, that's probably the only place you can find it because social media is killing it. Anytime the truth comes out, social media likes to kill it if it's anything that in any way dings anything liberal. So here's just one clip of Charlie Chester talking about the guests on CNN.
There's no such thing as unbiased news, technically. Any reporter on CNN.
Okay.
What they're actually doing is they're telling the person what to say. It's always like leading them in a direction before they even open their mouth. And the only people that we will let on the air, for the most part, are people that have a proven track record of taking the bait.
Well, that's just one of them. And I mean, he went on. I think they got together with him like four or five times. They didn't realize he was being taped. Fascinating story. Check that out at Project Veritas. I know Chris Plant featured some of it yesterday, too, so you could check out Chris's podcast as well. But great, great stuff. And kind of explains how the most trusted name in news operates, CNN.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In the news at this hour, the coroner's office has released the names of the eight people who were fatally shot when a man opened fire at a FedEx plant in Indianapolis yesterday. Four of the victims of the shooting were from Indianapolis's Sikh community. The mass shooting marks another blow for the Asian American community in the United States. The shooter has been identified as a 19-year-old former employee of FedEx. Police say he killed himself after shooting his victims. President Joe Biden and celebrities including Billy Crystal and Lin-Manuel Miranda are part of a TV special aimed at boosting COVID-19 vaccination rates. The special is entitled Roll Up Your Sleeves. It will air at 7 o'clock Eastern tomorrow night on NBC. It will also feature Charles Barkley, Shaquille O'Neal, lending their voices to the efforts, Matthew McConaughey as well, interviewing Dr. Anthony Fauci. A member of the Oath Keepers militia group has become the first defendant to plead guilty to federal charges in connection with the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, John Ryan Schaefer, also a heavy metal guitarist in the band Iced Earth, agreed to cooperate with investigators in hopes of getting a lighter sentence. And finally, the funeral for Prince Philip will be held in Great Britain today. There is a social side of it as well. Prince William and Prince Harry will not walk side by side as they follow their grandfather's coffin into the church ahead of Prince Philip's funeral. That will minimize the chances of any awkward moments between the brothers, who are grappling with strained relations since Harry's decision to step away from royal duties last year. 6:35, time for a check of the traffic and weather, and Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C. right now on 695 westbound, there is construction, and only one lane is getting past the work zone between 3rd Street Tunnel and the South Capitol Street exit. Traffic is jammed back to the 3rd Street Tunnel. In College Park on Cherry Hill Road southbound, there is construction at Baltimore Avenue, Route 1. In Centerville on 66 westbound, the Centerville exit, exit 53, off-ramp is closed. And exit 57 on 66 westbound, the off-ramp is closed. And on 66 eastbound, there is a disabled vehicle. Right lane is blocked right near 123. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV, with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
39 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:37.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Thank you for joining us on the Saturday Morning Update. We're glad you're here, and we're glad Jennifer Harper's here every weekend. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
A lot of questions swirling around the former president. What is he up to? What are his plans? What are you hearing?
Well, there's some very interesting developments this week, and you have to wonder, former President Trump has always been a very strategic kind of a guy and has a lot of things going on, and there are a lot of people that think that he may have some pretty serious secret strategies. A lot of analysts are saying, yes, he does, and this all got started about 4 months ago, and the exact date would be December 6, 2020. And amazingly enough, it was Senator Lindsey Graham. He made a very noteworthy comment about President Trump at the time. He said he has a lot of sway over the Republican Party. If he objects to anything Joe Biden does, it would be hard to get Republicans on board. If he blessed some kind of deal, it would be easier to get something done. In many ways, he'll be a shadow president. Well, guess what? This whole idea of Donald Trump being a shadow president has reemerged And one place that it did reemerge in a big way was, believe it or not, on CNN. This came from editor-at-large Chris Saliza. This is what he wrote. The 45th president and his supporters are building out a constellation of groups, political, legal, and policy, that parallel the structure of the National Republican Party. And yet more evidence that not only does Donald Trump have no plans to step away from politics, but that he is also constructing what amounts to be a shadow version of the GOP. So he was citing, Mr. Saliza was citing Mr. Trump's Save America Super PAC, the America First Policy Institute, and the America First Legal Foundation, all of them newly organized, up and running, and they're right under the nose of the GOP. And Mr. Saliza also had to say that the former president and all his new groups are in it for the long haul. He said, noting that the GOP base still sees Mr. Trump as its unquestioned leader, really, unquestioned leader, and that the Republican establishment could be marginalized both in the influence and fundraising. And I think one little historical note, and it's kind of an ironic one as well, because when President Trump took office on January 20th, 2017, way back, Republican voters were worried about the deep state. Remember that? And they all said there was a shadow government made up of a bunch of entrenched Democrats who were still working against the incoming president. And even a YouGov poll that week revealed that 65% of all voters and 76% of Trump voters had all heard of the deep state and its influence. So more to come on the shadow president, I should say, and what's in store for the GOP. Maybe next week.
So there's a lot of talk about the Republican Party being divided, but it seems one thing they do seem to rally on is their opposition to President Biden's border policy. And you have some interesting news as to what the lawmakers are finding at the southern border.
Yes, indeed. It's all week long we've heard, and probably for like 2 weeks now, we've heard, where is Vice President Kamala Harris? Why isn't she on the border? And she's given some excuses and so forth. But I did a little count of how many Republican lawmakers were down in the southern border this week alone, probably about 20 of them. They went on fact-finding missions and talked to Border Patrol people and did ride-alongs and so forth. I've got to give them a lot of credit for that. That's a lot of work to go down there. But let's talk about the 8 Republicans from the House Committee on Homeland Security who did go down to the Rio Grande Valley, and they followed up with the, quote, shocking realities that they found in a 10-point follow-up report that they released this week. And just a couple of little things. That it's good to have our lawmakers functioning as watchdogs this time, because they found that the Donna Processing Facility, this is in Donna, Texas, near the border, it costs $19.2 million per month to operate. And these Republicans were told that $50,000 per month is coming out of U.S. Customs and Border Protection's operational funds to pay for diapers. I repeat, $50,000 a month for diapers. That turned my head. And also they noted that 40% of the border agents have now been pulled from their national security duties to assist with, quote, migrant processing and their transportation and so forth. That can't be happy at all down there for either side. But anyway, the report said this leaves undeniable gaps in our border security posture. They noted that the Donna facility is meant to hold 500 individuals, but now holds 2,600, and that the migrant smuggling opportunities, notice, are now appearing in social media like Facebook and TikTok. So that's kind of what's going on down there. And I have a round of applause for the Republicans that are going down there, and we should just recognize them this morning. That group included Representative Catherine Kamek of Colorado, Andrew Klein of Georgia, Carlos Jimenez of Florida, Michael Guest of Mississippi, Diana Harshberger of Tennessee, Ranking Member John Katko of New York, and Peter Meyer of Michigan, and Marinette Miller Meeks of Iowa. So, yay for you guys.
I don't know why they all have to go down there. I mean, the Secretary of Homeland Security has told us repeatedly that the border is closed and it's secure. So, what's the problem?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that something as simple as getting a vaccination can become partisan. What is the latest on the politics of getting a shot?
Yeah, how about get the shot or not? And certainly everybody's all in a whirl over all the different reports that come out and the competing reports. But this is a fairly straight report on the partisan identity and the COVID vaccine. This is coming from our pals at Monmouth University, and they have found what a complicated decision this is. About one in five U.S. adults overall, that is 21%, remain unwilling to get the COVID vaccine. And according to Patrick Murray, he's a director of the independent Monmouth University Polling Institute, he says, partisanship remains the main distinguishing factor among those who want to avoid the vaccine altogether, with 43% of Republicans saying they remain unwilling to get the COVID vaccine. Again, 43% of Republicans are going, no, not going to do this, and only 5% of Democrats are saying this, along with 22% of independents. And demographically, adults under age 65, that would be 25% of them, continue to be more likely than seniors, 11%, to rule out getting the vaccine. And again, Mr. Murray says the number of people who have been skittish about the vaccine has dropped as more Americans line up for the shot, but the hardcore group who want to avoid it at all costs has barely budged. The recent news about Johnson & Johnson vaccine is probably not going to help that situation. On the other hand, it might not make it all that much worse, since much of this reluctance is really ingrained in partisan identity. So who you vote for has something to do with your vaccine. I'm not quite sure what, but there you go.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you. It is 6:45. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next, but first, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On 66 in Fairfax County, on the westbound side in Centerville, at 28, the Centerville exit 53, that off-ramp is closed. Exit 57 on the westbound side of 66, that off-ramp is also closed. There is a disabled vehicle. Right lane is blocked on the eastbound side of 66 near 123 exit 60. In D.C., 695, construction, only one lane gets past the road work between 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. And on Cherry Hill Road in College Park, construction, two right lanes are blocked right at Route 1. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV, with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Bruton in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
A crisp 39 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:46.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Always great to be joined by Jim Trusty. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the Department of Justice and now a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
Well, you've been around the federal court system for a good while, and we saw the press conference in front of the Supreme Court where progressives were calling for an additional four justices. How does that strike you from a legal perspective, not a political perspective, but just as an attorney who's been in the federal court system?
So I can't start off with the phrase horrific power grab, because that's what it really is here, but I mean, look, there's a reason why we've had nine justices since 1869. There's a stability to that number. It's not constitutionally required, but it has been the practice for a long time. And the whole concept the Constitution set up was for the Supreme Court to be above the fray of politics. You didn't want justices to feel the heat and noise that comes out of the political branches of government. And that's exactly what they're trying to change. They're trying to make it a politically responsive group where suddenly, if you don't like how it's going, you just add four, you know, to your political persuasion. to tilt the balance of the court. And to me, it's really just kind of a lawless, borderline unconstitutional, but a lawless political grab that I'm afraid is going to get some traction because it's being thrown out there with this potential bill, and then the commission that President Biden has appointed is going to spend some time talking about it too.
They call it a bipartisan commission, but I think when you look at the composition, it's sort of tilting in one direction.
Well, look, at the very least, the two commission co-chairs are absolutely doctrinaire liberal. I mean, in fact, both of them worked on political campaigns. These aren't just academics or lawyers that are interested in the Constitution. These are lawyers that spent some of their time helping the Obama and the Biden campaigns in terms of preparing for litigation about the election. So, yeah, that's a pretty serious level of advocacy for political candidates as opposed to being kind of an objective or disinterested observer. The makeup of it, frankly, it's very heavy on Ivy League and Harvard. There are some lawyers in there that I'm sure have a conservative tack overall. But, you know, it looks to me like it's going to be a group that, like most commissions, they're not going to come out with a conclusion that everything's fine and there's nothing to do. So the question is, how far are they going to reach? And I think there's a good chance with those two co-chairs, they're going to reach in the direction of changing the rules and changing the number of justices or their terms.
All right. You've seen Supreme Court decisions, and we know that there are conservative justices and liberal justices, at least the labels. But have you seen real politics, you know, almost a partisanship in any of the Supreme Court decisions? Or is it just more the ideology of, you know, socially liberal, socially conservative?
That's a great question, and it's a real hard one to answer. I think sometimes judicial philosophies tack fairly close to political philosophies. But one of the things that I always find interesting is it tends to be the conservative picks that are on the Supreme Court that are a little bit harder to predict. And, you know, you've heard a lot of concern about Roberts in recent years. Over time in history, there's been plenty of conservatively picked justices that tacked pretty far to the left in terms of how they would vote on any individual matter. I mean, Breyer is a pretty good example of that right now. So it's not automatic that, you know, the political party of that justice is going to perfectly predict where they go. I think in recent years, you had a very solid ability to predict where Ginsburg would go or Kagan or Sotomayor. They tended to be kind of a block vote on one side of the aisle. But again, I think, you know, you have to recognize these are all very, very intelligent, I think, principled people that make it through that gauntlet to become on the Supreme Court. And at least historically, they seem to be a very wise and principled bunch from my perspective. Doesn't mean I agree with every decision that comes through or every rationale that they employ, but I tend to think that they take the job incredibly seriously and don't try to be political in most instances.
One of the calls from progressives is for term limits, which sounds like age discrimination to me. But what is the constitutionality of term limits?
Well, you know, it's different than the number of justices. The number of justices is a straight statutory thing where Congress could, in fact, change it just by passing a law. What FDR did with his court backing scheme was he wedded the number of justices, the new number of justices, to mandatory retirement at 70. Basically said, if you don't retire at 70, I get to add a justice to the court until we get to 15. So that's really being revived in some circles right now. And if you look at the Article 3 of the Constitution, it basically says these justices can serve during good behavior, as they phrase it. And that tells me, at least, that there is no ability to impose an age limit without a constitutional amendment. I know there's people that debate this point, but I think it's pretty clear from reading it and from reading the entire Constitution when it comes to potential term limits that they intended to make it a position for life, again, above the fray of politics, and that was the reason why. So that's going to be a harder tack for any of these commission members or politicians to support because it would require a constitutional amendment.
Let's turn to the trial of Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Testimony completed at the end of the week. Closing arguments on Monday. And Jim, I know you've been watching the trial closely. Where would you assess the effectiveness of the defense?
Well, I think the prosecution's in pretty decent shape. And it doesn't mean the defense was terrible, but it does kind of bring to mind a philosophy I had for a long time as a prosecutor for about 27 years, or at least an observation I used to make. And that is, if you don't have a real powerful defense to present, including potentially your own client, sometimes it's better to present nothing. You know, a few borderline marginal facts or an expert opinion who's not that powerful, they don't really move the ball forward for the defense. Sometimes it's stronger to kind of not dignify the government's case by not putting on any testimony. And it's funny, I used to see cases where I said, well, my case wasn't great, but it got better because the defense was weak. And I think that's a little bit where we might be in Minnesota with this trial. They had an expert come on and really come up with something that hadn't been telegraphed in this case, a theory that carbon monoxide was a cause of death for George Floyd. And I don't think that's going to sell all that well with this jury that watched that videotape, you know, with 9.5 minutes of neck compression. So, again, sometimes a weak defense is considerably worse than no defense.
So I guess part of what the defense is trying to do is to create reasonable doubt as to the death of George Floyd. And you just kind of laid out there that that was a stretch to try and go with carbon monoxide. Anything else in there that you saw that the prosecution didn't put to rest in terms of reasonable doubt?
Well, that's for, you know, 12 people to decide, probably easier than I will. But look, I think they anticipated a lot of the defense. They knew there was going to be these stories about fentanyl and about how Mr. Floyd had consumed serious quantities of that drug. That's why they talked about drug tolerance pretty early into this case to suggest that he could handle that amount of drugs without serious medical problems. So, look, it's not, none of these are easy cases. The charges are very nuanced. The difference between depraved heart, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter, those are very kind of tricky legal concepts. And so the jury's got a lot to chew on there in terms of how they characterize the conduct. But, again, I think that 9 minutes of the videotape where Officer Chauvin is just quite nonchalant and comfortable with his position on George Floyd is one of those facts that's just almost impossible for 12 people to overcome. So I think they're going to get to a verdict on something, and I think there's a solid chance that it could be a second or third degree murder, but at the very least, the manslaughter.
Well, Jim, at the same time this is going on, of course, the tragic shooting in Brooklyn Center, Officer Kim Potter charged with second degree manslaughter within 3 days of the shooting. Due process was a big question right from the start, and the city manager had called for due process, and the media had asked him whether the officer should be fired, and he said she was entitled to due process. He said that, and the mayor fired him for saying it. Whatever happened to due process?
Yeah, it's dying on the street, it seems like, and it seems to be very selectively employed in this country right now, and that's a big concern. So, you know, I know there's a videotape. I know that it's a shocking moment to see this officer shoot the man when she's thinking it's a taser. That's obviously a horrible moment, a horrible mistake. But I don't think police shootings, fatal or not, in an incendiary climate or not, should be considered fully investigated just 3 days in. And, you know, this shooting brings to me the question of the difference between negligence and gross negligence. You know, negligence is not usually criminal. Manslaughter and second-degree manslaughter requires some sort of gross negligence to support a charge. And I just think to not take the time to weed through this and to consider witness statements and maybe even consider letting Officer Potter testify in the grand jury if she wants to, I mean, none of that seems to be taking place. We're kind of in this period of rushing to judgment because of a police officer being involved in an interracial incident. And just one quick thing about that statute, Rick. You know, the statute, the language of it, to me, tells you it's a pretty complex charge. It's that the person, that the defendant caused the death of another by their culpable negligence, whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm to another. that's a mouthful. That's pretty tangled stuff to sift through if you're a prosecutor or an investigator. And I'm not really confident that anybody can do a good job of sifting through the evidence in 3 days before making a charging decision like this.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much for the perspectives.
Sure. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you too. 7 o'clock news coming up. Then it's John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and K.T. McFarland on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.